Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Monday at 3:18. I mean, by now you have to know this. I find it hard to believe that I'm surprising anybody with this, but Friday afternoon, 3:18 p.m., we here in Hamilton and this part of the world are going to be experiencing a total eclipse of the sun. The only thing missing is going to be Bonnie Tyler singing her song. But you know what? Maybe the next time. But this is a very cool event. I mean, I've got my glasses. I am looking forward to this. I think it's really one of those things that we don't get to see very often, if hardly ever, maybe once in our lifetime. So yeah, it's a cool thing. And there's lots of people who are planning to go to Tim Hortons Field, go to Niagara, all the rest. All that terrific. All that cool, because everybody should, if you're interested, should want to be excited about this and everything else. However, there's a secondary part to this that I'm finding really fascinating. And it's the preemptive panic, it seems. And when I say that, and maybe panic is too strong a word, but you know, our schools, they moved to PA day, so that kids won't be in school that day. And we have Niagara declaring a state of emergency ahead of time. And there are places down in the states, Ohio in some places, Texas in some places, suggesting that you stock up, Kentucky, saying you should stock up on food and water and be ready for almost anything. I'm not sure I'm understanding how we go from 4 minutes-ish of darkness to this. But maybe my next guest can. Nomi Claire Lazar is a full professor in public and international affairs at the University of Ottawa. She's author of the book States of Emergency in Liberal Democracy. She joins us now. Thank you for the time today.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
How do we get here? Because again, this is a really neat thing, a really fun thing, a cool thing to see. Where does the jump come in some people's minds to go from that to, oh, this is going to be a problem?
Well, I think that there are several things going on here. One that's specific to Niagara, which I'll get to in a minute. But another is this sense that we have as human beings that the sun rises in the morning and then it sets at night and the day is light and the night is dark. And for all of human history, we've tended to get, for lack of a better phrase, completely freaked out by eclipses. So I don't think that it's entirely surprising that people are feeling a little jittery, a little excited, especially since many people have never seen one. In addition, there's something else going on, another celestial phenomenon at the same time that people seem to be getting confused about, and that's that the sun is at its peak of its 11-year cycle of solar flares, and that does sometimes impact satellites, and it does sometimes cause blackouts, etc. And people seem to be confusing these two things and expecting that the eclipse itself is going to cause damage to infrastructure. So I think that's one thing. The case of Niagara is a little different, though. So as far as I understand, Niagara is expecting about 1 million people to descend on their town. And so let's be straight here. That's a real threat. So we have an infrastructure that's designed for visitors, but not 1 million visitors all at once. And so I think this is at the root of the panic in Niagara, because that really is a real threat. It's not clear that the streets can handle the traffic. And that means if something happens, you know, the day-to-day stuff like fire or someone needs an ambulance, those vehicles can't get to you if the traffic's snarled up. It's not clear the sewage system can frankly handle that many people or the cell system, but a threat is not the same as an emergency. And this is where things get a little concerning. What I would like to know is why, given that there's been all of this time for Niagara to prepare, they're using emergency powers rather than other emergency preparedness tools to get ready. So is this just to draw people's attention and perhaps the province's attention to the fact that they're facing this challenge? Is it incompetence? They didn't, you know, prepare early enough? Or did they try to prepare and hit a wall? And if the last one is true, then the province needs to take a serious look at its emergency preparedness situation to make sure that there are ways for municipalities to get the resources they need in a situation like this to prevent a threat from becoming an emergency. It shouldn't come to a declaration of emergency.
Yeah, and let me just go back. There's a couple things you said there I want to jump into a little further, but let's go back just to something you said right at the beginning where this has always freaked us out. I agree historically that that would be true, especially, you know, hundreds of years ago, all of a sudden this happens. You go, whoa, what in the world? It's 2024. With all that we know, surely there should be nobody left freaked out, except maybe, maybe in some other part of the world where it's, you know, still not with the technology we have now, but around here, surely no one's going to be surprised or weirded out by this, are they?
Well, you would think so. And I should point out my last solar eclipse was in Indonesia and people were not freaking out there, even though they were just watching the show. I think it might have something to do with the fact that our culture right now is very wound up. And
really? Just a little, yes.
A little bit. And so we're sort of looking, I think we're sort of primed, the kind of risk management structures in our brains are sort of primed for anything that could be the cause of the next, the next sort of semi-collapse. We're just kind of in that mind frame.
Well, and that's the second part of what I was going to say, is that I when you say about, you know, risk versus emergency, that would be the one thing that would concern me because of what you just also said about, you know, we're a little bit on edge. This, you know, we always hear about huge crowds are opportunities for people who have malicious intents. That would be my concern. And what is being done to make sure that everybody's safe in such a circumstance? Because if this is being planned, as you say, just in the last few days, what preparedness is there if there was, heaven forbid, someone who had a bad idea?
Well, goodness, I hadn't even thought of that possibility. I was still thinking about ambulances and that kind of thing. But you're quite right that anytime people congregate, it does pose the risk of some kind of action. I mean, the political science part of my brain is kind of thinking, you know, maybe there aren't that. Yeah, I would be surprised.
I would too. Of course. Of course we all would, I think. And I don't even like to think it, honestly, but I mean, we're reminded of this every New Year's when New York City has, you know, New Year's Eve, and they're always talking about, oh, we got to be really careful about everything that happened. And yeah, I don't know, but it's it is an interesting thing that and again, I don't even know where we got to with the some of these cities in the States that are saying stock up on food and water, because I'm not even entirely sure what they're expecting is going to happen, that all the crops will fail. I don't know what they're all about, but they're out there saying load up.
Sorry. Yeah, that does seem very, very strange to me. But I think the more immediate potential risks are things like snarled traffic with people not being prepared. So I'm planning to take my family down to watch by the North Shore of the St. Lawrence, from here in Ottawa. And we are going to be, you know, doing some emergency preparedness. So we're going to be making sure we have food and, you know, a couple extra blankets. And because, you know, I don't know whether a million people are going to decamp down there from Ottawa. So it does make sense to be prepared if you're going out on the roads, just because of traffic, frankly. But, you know, freaking out and kind of, you know, storing up food and water in the house does seem to be overreacting a bit. I mean, I would love for us to see this instead as something that's going to be absolutely, you know, amazing.
Sure.
Once in a lifetime, thing to watch. Especially as I said before, that, you know, the sun is at its peak solar flare period. And so when we have totality, we may see a truly spectacular show because we can see the solar flares during totality.
Yeah. And I think, and I fully expect that what you just said is what is going to be the case, that it will be a big celebration. Everyone will have a great time. I just am always amazed at how people can leap to, we have to be expecting Armageddon if the sun is going to disappear for 4 minutes. Well, who knows?
Maybe people want Armageddon. maybe they get excited by it. It's an adventure.
Maybe we'll choose a different thing other than Armageddon to be excited about. But Nomi Claire Lazar, professor in public and international affairs at the University of Ottawa. You can also find her book, States of Emergency in Liberal Democracies. Really appreciate you taking time today. Thanks for this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, and enjoy the eclipse.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We were just talking about the eclipse, and I'm assuming many of you will be tuning into that. If you need something to do before the eclipse, though, a few days before Saturday, for example, you can head down to the John Foote Armory. That's the armory on James North for a couple of reasons. One is because there is going to be a military tattoo going on in the armories with the Argyle pipes and drums and maybe others. I'm not really sure. But also because this is a recruiting event for different groups within the Hamilton military units, whether it's the Argyles or whether it's the Navy, the Field Ambulance Service Battalion, the all of them, including the group that my next guest is the honorary colonel for, or I guess grammatically more correctly, for which she is honorary colonel. Her name is Dr. Jean Chamberlain. She joins me now. Doctor, how are you today?
Very good, thank you.
Appreciate you doing this because I find this so interesting because I know that in the past, Ron Foxcroft, for example, was honorary colonel of the Argyles. I don't think he has any military background. He could correct me. I don't believe you have any military background, and you are the honorary colonel for the Signalers. How did you get involved in this before we get into this whole recruitment thing?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, a lot of honorary colonels don't necessarily have a military background. Before me, actually, our former president, McMaster, was the honorary colonel. So someone who I knew was in the military and said, you know, hey, we need some representation, people like you. I'm a McMaster professor and in medicine. I've done a lot of global work, and I've really seen the value of the military, both in Canada as well as around the world, and how Canadian military is so respected in other parts of the world where I've lived in the Middle East and in Africa. So I just thought, you know, this is a moment just to get engaged and, you know, put my voice to really supporting the Canadian military.
A lot of people, I think, when they hear about joining the military, they think of like fighting, which naturally that potentially could be part of it. When you say, though, that you've seen the value of Canadian military, we haven't been fighting a lot lately. So what have you seen as the value of our military overseas and elsewhere?
Well, you certainly see the Canadian Armed Forces in peacekeeping efforts, and when there's instability, they're there. And just their presence helps people on the ground when there's a conflict going on between certain groups. When they see the Canadian flag there, there's just a lot of respect there. And the area that I'm involved in, actually, I'm the honorary colonel for the 31st Signal Regiment. So signalers are in charge of communications. I mean, back in the day, they used to be the people sort of putting the lights from one light to the next light to the next light, in terms of the communications. But now, of course, it's much more complicated than that. And so that's the area that I'm involved in. So it's not about, again, the shooting and that sort of thing, but it's about communications and how important that is, especially in our Canadian North. That's a really important part the signalers also play, is being able to communicate in the, you know, really rough environments like the Canadian North, where the military really helps to keep a presence and keep peace and to keep, especially in times of disasters, that they can play a role.
This recruiting opportunity is, as I said right off the top, is for all kinds of different things, whether it's the Army, the Navy, the Signals, all of them. Is this then, like, who is this for? Who is eligible if they were interested in signing up? Is this only for 18, 19, 16-year-olds? Or, like, who would the Army, who would the Signals be looking for?
Well, I think they'd be looking for anybody who is interested in serving with the Canadian Armed Forces. And you're right, we have people who are in high school. You can do a co-op program. You can imagine getting high school credits for doing a co-op program with the Canadian Armed Forces. They actually get paid. I mean, how many times you get paid for doing a co-op? So we have students in high school through university. Of course, we have students from McMaster, from Mohawk, from all the different colleges that join the military, but then people a little bit later in life as well. Myself, I won't tell you how old I am, but I've certainly passed the 50 mark, and, you know, I've gotten involved in this way. So there's lots of roles for different people, wherever your skills are, and you certainly see the individuals involved with Canadian Armed Forces many different ages. So I think it's someone who is looking for a new opportunity, for training, for education. There's great teamwork that goes on when you're part of the Canadian Armed Forces, and really, there's great people, and I think it's got a lot of people right now are in a time in their lives where they want to do something bigger than just themselves, and, you know, Canada does play an important role with the Canadian military, helping to protect Canadians and other vulnerable people around the world, so that's really who they're looking for.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but when you talk about things like a high school internship, if you were to sign up, are you committed? Are you locked in for years, or can this be a short-term thing?
Absolutely. It's just a short-term thing with an opportunity to do more if you want to. And, you know, you would actually have employment in the summers if you want to. You get trained and actually paid as a reservist if you want to. Of course, it's always volunteer, but you start as a co-op and you, again, are reimbursed for that time. You get your high school credit for it. And then you have the option to go on and get the basic military training if you want to, where, again, you're going to get paid for that. So a lot of people are looking for, you know, employment as well, too. So it's not always just somebody who has an altruistic view as well, too. They may just need, like, a good part-time job. And that's really what the reservists are about as well, too, is having, you know, something that you're committed to, but is also really interesting and rewarding for you. And there's also opportunities for education as well, too, like actually the government will help with some of your university education, college education as well, too, if you're a reservist. So there's lots of good reasons to join.
Let me go back to something you said a moment ago about wanting to help and wanting to do something significant. I mean, people who may know your background may not. You're someone who could have been a doctor here full time. You have done much of your work overseas, started a group called Save the Mothers in the developing world to help with maternal health things. You clearly feel the idea about wanting to make a difference and do something. Do you get, when you hear from people, do you get the sense that that is something that more and more people are wanting to do? Not necessarily save the mothers. I mean, just having that job or that impact beyond themselves.
Well, I think so. Yeah, people are looking for that. And the challenge is finding something that really fits you. And so I think that's the one thing that's attracted me to the Canadian Armed Forces, that there's so many different things that you can get involved in. You know, if you're into computers and telecommunications, the signalers are for you. If you're into, you know, health, and, you know, you may want to go into the ambulance services and healthcare. So there's so many different ways. People, again, just think of the Canadian Armed Forces as, you know, somebody with a gun, but there's so much more than that. And really great opportunities to make a difference. Again, they get involved with humanitarian efforts, with so many emergencies that happen. It's the Canadian Armed Forces that step up. And so if you want to be part of that, and it's not like, again, it's a full-time thing where you have to, like, you give up your other job or your other work, whatever. It can be a part-time thing. And then if you fall in love with it and want to do it full-time, that's fine as well, too. Then it gives you that option.
That is Dr. Jean Chamberlain. She is honorary colonel for the Signalers. They are part of the open house and recruitment this Saturday. Doctor, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. We look forward to seeing people at 1 o'clock, 200 James Street at the Armory.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Something that comes up in this country every now and then. It's a topic that seems to emerge sporadically, often when something terrible has happened, quite frankly. And today we're talking about it because of a new poll that's out by Research Co. The number of Canadians who would be interested in seeing capital punishment return is edging up. And there are, it's not quite a majority of Canadians yet who are there, but if you look around the country, 62% in Manitoba, 60% now in Atlantic Canada, 60% in Alberta, 58% of British Columbians, 57% of Ontarians, and 52% of Quebecers support the idea of bringing back capital punishment. Now, there is a caveat to this, because if you ask, okay, capital punishment or having a system where you could be sentenced in this country to life in prison with no chance of parole, as can be done in the States, the number goes up even higher, considerably higher. But whether it's we want people to be able to be put away forever because they've done something truly awful, or we want them to be executed, it seems to be that there is a sentiment here, if I'm reading this correctly, that people, a lot of people, believe that our system is not punishing sufficiently. Let me bring in Andrew Fergielli. He is a criminal defense lawyer with Fergielli Law. Joins us now. Andrew, thanks for doing this today.
My pleasure, Scott. And I assume I'm ineligible to answer that quiz question you had off the top.
Well, don't say it now, but we'll put you on hold at the end and you can answer it because I bet you could. What do you think about this idea, about my theory right off the top, that when you see these numbers creeping up, there's got to be something behind it, which may be that people feel dissatisfied that our system is too soft?
I think that's part of it. And I think part of it comes from sort of the way news cycles go and which stories will crop up and grab the public's attention, because the crime figures for serious crime, just in answer to your theory about dissatisfaction, when you look at the actual numbers for serious crime, aside from maybe spikes that you'll get in certain cities from in off years, they're lower than they've always been. And comparing Canada's per capita numbers for violent crime for big cities to other cities around the world, we've come out looking very good. So I think you're right in part. The concern I have is how based it is in the reality of what we're dealing with in terms of, for really what we're talking about, murder rates and serious crime like that.
Well, and I think you're probably very much bang on when it's about, you know, the moment. And I cannot help but think that this kind of a poll and this kind of a response happening right around the time that we've heard about Paul Bernardo being moved to medium security and what's his name? The other
Luca Magnotta
being moved to medium security probably has some impact on this, that their names come up again and people look and go, they're on a campus instead of in maximum security. We got to do something about this. That, I have to believe there's a connection.
I think so. And also, I mean, I don't want this to sound trivial in any way, but we've all known for some time that serious crime drives clicks and serious crime drives media. And you know, you're getting other news stories that come out. This is also coming in the wake of the individual who's found guilty for first degree murder for the what has been decided by the sentencing judges, the terrorist attack in London. With right. The family yep. that was run over. You have a lot of other stories like that. So I think in the wake of those stories and in the wake of the stories involving who I'll call are sort of the worst offenders, poll numbers like this and polls like this are going to have that skew in that moment for those responders. And I feel, though, that when you sort of take a step back and you think about it, and I was glad this poll created options for the respondents, you see those numbers track back down.
Right, and I think if you had asked the question, do you believe in capital punishment for Paul Bernardo, the number would be about 98%, because there are always going to be certain cases that just blow our brains apart and we just can't wrap our head around it. We go, how is this person allowed to live at all? I get that part of it. I do wonder if there's any political case for this, though. Could you ever imagine a political party in this country now introducing something like this, or would that just be a complete waste of time because ultimately it would never happen?
So first off, I sincerely hope not. But putting my own hopes aside, I hope that no political party would try it, just to be clear. But even if a political party did, there's some significant hurdles with respect to it. The first is that there is a Supreme Court decision that was unanimous from the Supreme Court essentially made clear that the death penalty would violate the Charter and wouldn't be able to be saved as a reasonable limit to its violation. So there is precedent on the books where the Supreme Court has already said if the death penalty were to come back, I can't imagine that it would be allowed to stand as a constitutional remedy. And you saw recently as well with the stacking of parole ineligibility by the Supreme Court, that decision which came out last year, where they found even that to be cruel and unusual punishment for someone who has committed, say, two murders, to get 50 years of parole ineligibility was found to be charter violating. And the legislation was struck down, the death penalty would be there'd be an even stronger argument to strike it down. So I think it it would be a very tall task for any government to even start going down that road.
And thank you for, again, bringing up that, because I really believe, and again, whether it's the Bernardo case or the, you know, 50 years consecutive terms is unfair, I really believe that there have been enough cases, they don't even have to be the worst cases, just enough cases where people in this country are feeling like the system is not strong enough or is being too much leaning towards the rights of the offender, that may also be part of the reason here. This may be taking it to the nth degree, but I think people are in a lot of places dissatisfied or feeling like the system is too lenient.
And you know, a part of that is sort of what we give oxygen to in the system. And I'll give you another example of that. You have a number of politicians talking about how bail laws are too relaxed these days and too many people are getting out on bail. And every time there's an offense committed by somebody who was out on bail, the politicians come out and hold that up as a sign that the bail laws are too weak. What you don't get is every day in this country, across this country, people who have been in pretrial custody without bail are found not guilty or have their charges withdrawn. And they get zero attention by the media, by the public. And so there's an imbalance, I believe, and has always been there, in not just in what the media covers, but in what we want to consume as a public from our criminal justice system. The outrage sells. And the outrage is strongest when we view a terrible offender getting a treatment that is viewed as too lenient. And so I'm always very wary about this idea of creeping dissatisfaction, because there's reason to be dissatisfied on the other side of the ledger, that things are too crime control and that doesn't get reported with equal force.
And I think you raise a very good point about the idea that there's a lot of people who, I don't know if it's a lot, there are people who spend time in custody, are found not guilty, but have been unable to get bail. I mean, it's a very fair point, for sure. What about the idea of repeat offenders, though? Could there be an argument to be made that, I don't know, if you've done time, if you're a recidivist, that your bail should be stricter or the penalty should be much harsher than they are? We're not going to crush you. And we're not even talking about murder or something. I'm talking about less, but we're not going to crush you with the first time. But you know what? If you do it again, our system is going to really be a lot stiffer. Is there an argument to be made there?
It's already happening. I mean, in the bail courts, there are individuals who have had a serious crime on their record who then get charged again, who do get bail. But it's much more difficult. And a large number of people who have a strike on their record, that is held against them in a bail hearing. And it's held against them and it's used as aggravating in every sentencing that we see. So it's there. It's just certain cases will get more reported in instances where someone, say, a recidivist does get bail, or where a recidivist still gets a lesser sentence without really the understanding of why that lesser sentence might have happened in that particular case. So should somebody who has a criminal record find it more difficult to get bail? Yes, and they do. It does happen in the day-to-day workings of the bail courts every day across this country.
Here's one that you're not a political scientist, you're a lawyer, so maybe it's an unfair question, but I'm going to throw it to you anyway, because one of the things I was very surprised about when I looked at the numbers in this poll is they broke it down by all kinds of different things, but also by age groups. And overall, older people over 55 are more supportive of bringing back capital punishment. I'm not surprised about that. I would have expected that number. But the largest jump in people supporting capital punishment is in the 18 to 34 group. That does surprise me that group, it seems to be more people. As I say, the number from the last time they did this poll till now, that's the largest increase group. That surprises me.
I think there's it feels to me like there's been a bit of a general trend where younger generations, which have always just been considered as a block, like more liberal or more left wing, there's been a bit of a pendulum swing back. Whereas by and large, I think that's still true if you look at it in the macro. But I think you'll see increasing numbers of younger people who will take and I hate to use this shorthand, but I'll use it here, the right wing position, if I can put it that way. I think you'll see, you do see these days more people in that age bracket identifying in that way than perhaps you saw at the early part of the millennium or earlier than that. So that doesn't surprise me with those numbers. But I still think in the macro, I think you're correct to identify that generally speaking, the older an individual gets as they age and they go through the system or the political system and go through life as they get senior, you'll see that more conservative bent, which is much more indicative of somebody who would be more interested in the death penalty coming back.
Yeah, I don't think there's much surprise there. Okay, I've got a couple minutes left here. And the opposite to this, or no, it's not the opposite, the other alternative, and you mentioned, you know, you were glad that there was an alternative offered in this poll. The alternative is, all right, whether you like the idea of bringing back the death penalty or not, what do you think about life in prison as truly life in prison? And that one seems to be much more popular even than bringing back capital punishment. You've pointed out absolutely correctly, of course, that the court, the appeals court, or was the Supreme Court, I can't remember, has said it's cruel and unusual punishment to sentence someone to 50 years. It's 225s and they're concurrent, not consecutive. Yeah, they're concurrent. Would there be, do you believe, political will or a popular position for some party to take to say, we're going to try to push this through. We're going to try and change it so that if you were one of the worst, if you were that guy in London who mowed down that family with their car, you could do 4 25-year sentences in a row. So you go away for life and we don't have to worry about you popping out again.
So the first point I'd make is just a reminder to everybody that on a first degree murder conviction where it's life 25, the presumption is life. The presumption is exactly what you're asking for, which is that this individual spend the rest of their life in a penitentiary. 25 years simply means that's the earliest date, 25 years from the date of their arrest, upon which they can first apply for parole. And the numbers of people who get parole at 25 years off a first-degree murder sentence is incredibly low. And the numbers of people who get parole at any point after one of those convictions is very low. And then the recidivism rates of people who do get parole after a murder sentence, after they've gone through their period of ineligibility, those recidivism rates are equally very, very low. So that's number one. Number two, I absolutely think there's a political appetite to try this again, but the Supreme Court made it clear that any legislation where you stack it and make it so that it's life with no chance of parole, essentially, is not going to fly. And the other part of the reason, Scott, and I know you're running short on time, so I'll be quick.
No, it's okay. We got time. It's okay.
The other part of this is, if you're going to strip away that maximum, and this was an argument that I think had some force at the Supreme Court, if you're going to strip away the maximum, then I think you need to strip away the minimum, too. Mm. For second-degree murder, there's a minimum period of parole ineligibility of 10 years, right? For second degree, it's anywhere between 10 and 25 years, and the judge sets that. But that minimum is still there. And there are instances where people may well go down for murder where you could say to yourself, I could see this person being on parole before 15 years or 20 years or 10 years, but the minimum is still there. So it would be very interesting to see if a government says, we're going to wipe out all the numbers here in terms of minimums and maximums, and it's just going to be life with a period of parole and eligibility to be set by a trial judge. And if that would happen, I'd be very intrigued to see how the Supreme Court dealt with that. But if you're just going to blow off the ceiling, there's an unfairness there. And that's what all the legislation's been focused on. And that's part of the reason I think that the Supreme Court hasn't liked the legislation to date. And I've seen no signal that they would change their mind at this point.
You mentioned that there was the presumption of life, although you could get parole after 25. That, however, while 100% true, once again, you're correct. I'm not disputing your correctness on that. But recently, again, we saw the Bernardo thing. One thing I would absolutely expect if the Conservatives win the next election, if Polyev wins, I would absolutely expect that there will be some kind of change. Okay, we can't stack the consecutive sentences back to back, but you will do all of your time if you are convicted in maximum security in a penitentiary, as opposed to what we have now. That, I think, would be at least a very popular position that people would latch onto if they can't even do any of the other things.
It would be the people I'd want to hear from on that, though, are the prison guards. Because when you're talking about penitentiaries and you're talking about essentially warehousing a number of people who've been convicted of very, very serious crimes, the idea of being able to cascade down from maximum to medium and then medium to minimum for good behavior for a lot of individuals is a really powerful tool to keep things in line in those institutions. It fits a lot of our models of the idea of rehabilitation. And it frankly, I think, makes life easier for the people who, on any view, are going in there as guards and risking their lives to do that job. And if you take that away, I'd be curious to see what they would think about that. My sense is, I don't think they'd like it very much. The idea that for good behavior, there is no reward. For a prolonged period of positive behavior and pro-social behavior inside, there is no reward to cascade down to an area where you're still within walls, but you have a bit more freedom within those walls to be able to take programming, take courses, cook your own meals, etc. And so it's a lot more complex than just that very simple answer of keep them in an 8x10 cell as long as you can forever. That I don't know that really matches the reality of what the people on the ground would like to see.
Fascinating topic. People can look, if you want to read more about this or look up this poll, go to researchco.ca and you'll be able to find the poll on the death penalty in Canada in 2024. Andrew Ferjuelli, really appreciate you taking time to talk about this today. Thank you.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.